Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Since 1979, TireRack.com has been helping people find the right tires for how, what, and where they drive. They sell only the best, like the full line of Yokohama tires. Test results, ratings, and reviews are there to assist. Or try the Tire Decision Guide to get a personalized tire recommendation. Tires ship fast and free to you or to one of over 10,000 recommended installers. In many areas, they offer mobile tire installation. Shop Yokohama tires at TireRack.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a burning pilot avow of revenge, the U.S. weighs arms for Ukraine, and measles on many minds. Anger on the streets of Jordan after a Jordanian pilot was burned alive by ISIS. In Ukraine, Secretary of State John Kerry calls for diplomacy as Washington talks lethal aid.
We want a diplomatic resolution, but we cannot close our eyes to tanks that are crossing the border from Russia and coming in to Ukraine.
And more measles and calls to tighten vaccination exemptions. A California mother, baby in her arms, says vaccinate.
We do it. We do it because it protects our kids and it protects our community. And we count on other parents to do it too.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with James Kitfield of the National Journal, Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. With us today from Houston, Texas, is James Kitfield, contributing editor for the National Journal, senior fellow at the Center for the Presidency and Congress. James Kitfield, welcome back to On Point.
Happy to be here, Tom.
With us from Washington, Lisa Lehrer, reporter for Bloomberg Politics. Lisa, welcome back. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, James, and Lisa.
Let's go straight to that outrage in the Middle East, in Jordan in particular. Jordanian pilot spectacularly, gruesomely burned alive. Here's his father calling for revenge.
I demand that none of the criminals should be spared. I demand that the vengeance should be more severe than just executing prisoners. I demand that the Islamic State should be wiped out. This is a murderous and despicable group that is condemned by the whole world.
And here's Jordan's State Minister Mohammed al-Mamani speaking with CNN yesterday, saying Jordan will work more closely with the coalition to fight Daesh or ISIS.
Our intelligence services, as well as our military, will be looking more intensely into finding new targets, into hitting hard on the Daesh strongholds.
James Kitfield, what's your sense of this? Has the Islamic State jumped the shark this week with this outrageous violence against a Jordanian pilot? Is it possible that they're eliciting such revulsion or determination to get rid of them that it could, you know, turn the tide against them or on the ground? Are they still digging in?
Well, let's certainly hope that this will turn the tide. If anyone needs to know, you know, what these people are about, we were reminded, in, as you said, very gruesome fashion this week with this really disgusting video of burning this pilot alive. But we've seen it with these beheadings. There's a report out from the UN this week that they're, you know, putting in a bounty and capturing and enslaving children. I mean, these guys are as bad as ever come down the pike. And at some point, you know, this plays to a certain group of recruits, you know, this kind of violence, this idea that there's a caliphate out there that they can go fight for. But it's a small minority, and I would suggest it's going to be a ever-decreasing minority because the vast majority of Muslims, as well as the rest of the world, are disgusted by these tactics.
Jack, it was disgusting this week, but turn the tide? That's a more practical question. You can look online and easily find jihadis saying, hey, look, one pilot burned here. Look at the American attacks on civilians in Iraq. Hundreds of thousands died. Does this change the actual calculus of this conflict on the ground, Jack?
Well, you know, the headline in yesterday's Times, militant killing of Jordanian pilot unites the Arab world in anger. Unites. That hasn't happened in a long time. And yep. Not just the Arab world, but Iran as well. People point on that side, point to the capability of Jordan. We heard from a reporter there just the other day that Jordan has apparently some of the most elite special forces units in the world. They've got over 1,300 tanks, 250 aircraft, etc. On the other side, we have the UAE pulling out of the coalition. Why? They don't want their pilots caught and immolated. Well, to counter that fear, we now have said we're going to move our search and rescue capability from Iraq closer to the Syrian border so that we can go and sort of grab pilots who are shot down. Now, wait a minute. Does that mean our people might get caught and immolated? You know, yes, this has created tremendous anger. But there's a firewall to that anger, and that's the deep-seated alienation of young people throughout the Arab world, throughout Jordan, where the United States' popularity is something like 12%. It may be, though, that this is what you were talking about months ago, Tom, when we did our first show on ISIS, the self-limiting quality of its savagery. We saw that in Iraq, where al-Qaeda simply lost its support. And perhaps there's some dynamic like that at work.
Lisa Lara, bring us to the politics of this at home. The president has been asking for a specific authorization to go after Islamic State ISIS from Congress. He hasn't got that yet. Brought it up in the State of the Union, still looking for it. This was at a news conference just yesterday, House Speaker John Boehner saying it will be a heavy lift to get this.
His actions are going to be an important part of trying to get for us to get the votes to actually pass an authorization. This is not going to be an easy lift.
Lisa Lara, what are the dynamics in Congress around this? Is it a peace impulse, let's not go back to war, that's saying keep our foot off the accelerator here? Or why not an easy lift? Maybe it's a good thing it's not an easy lift. We've had, you know, easier lifts on this before, gone to war that we've regretted. But what are the dynamics, Lisa?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on here, and I think the speaker's right that it's not going to be an easy lift. On the Democratic side, folks on that side of the aisle are reluctant to approve a new war power resolution unless there's a clear deadline or some way to pay for it. They still feel a little burnt by the operation in Iraq, that, you know, there's certainly a contingent of Democrats who just do not like to approve this sort of thing. On the Republican side, they're really strong opponents of the president. They've opposed him at every turn, and they're not going to like giving him expanded authority. So the president and the administration is going to have to do a really strong lobbying push on Capitol Hill, and they haven't had a lot of success with that. They don't have a lot of juice on Capitol Hill. The president, of course, is now really a lame duck. So I think it's going to be hard. Now, the thing that could be working in his favor is we are moving into a presidential cycle, and you will have a number of Republicans wanting to demonstrate their foreign policy credentials who may be certainly eager to have this debate. Even if they won't necessarily side with the president, they may come around eventually. So, but it's going to be pretty hard. It's not going to be something easy. And of course, there still is a fear that although Americans, I think most Americans are outraged by what we're seeing coming out of the region, they don't necessarily want troops on the ground. And that's, of course, not what the White House is talking about. But these issues tend to get conflated in these kinds of debates.
Let's bring our listeners in right here. Thank you, Lisa. Matt in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I really think this is a turning point. I think ISIS has finally overplayed their hand and showed themselves for the true barbarians that they are. In a way, they are worse than the Nazis. The Nazis at least had the sense to try to hide their crimes. They understood that any normal person would be revolted by what they were doing. This is something new in the world today, barbarians who are actually proud of being murderers. We haven't seen this since Genghis Khan, and I think the world is finally waking up, and I hope the U.S. wakes up too. And we sent all that military force into Iraq for no purpose. I think one tank brigade could wipe them out in no time. And
Matt, I hear you on a lot of fronts, but when you get to that point, I really wonder. We sent over 100,000 plus troops. And look, Iraq was not fixed in the end. Are you so sure that what the answer is for the U.S. to get in there? Maybe that's part of what set the stage for ISIS in the first place.
I'm not sure. Of course, it's what set the stage for ISIS in the first place.
Yeah. Matt, I appreciate your call. James Kitfield, practically on the ground, it's ultimately an imponderable how this plays out. I mean, some may be disgusted. Others may have the fear put into them. The UAE pulling its pilots here. Are there practical changes on the ground that could come from this? Among them, Jordan allying with Assad, even the U.S. essentially backing Assad after everything that's been said to try and turn this around with ISIS. Could that happen?
I think that you'll see Assad increasingly sidelined on this with sort of a wink and a nod. We're doing it already with the fact that our aircraft are flying over Syria and not being fired on by his surface-to-air missiles.
Is that sidelined or embraced?
Well, not embraced because, the priority list is ISIS first, but everyone understands, certainly in the United States and certainly in the region, that Assad is not part of the long-term solution for Syria. In fact, the Assad civil war is what gave rise to ISIS. And until he is out of the picture, that country is going to be in the middle of a civil war that's going to create terrorist groups like ISIS, like al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda franchise. So, but the priority clearly is on ISIS. We're building and we're not going to have an invasion by U.S. combat brigades. But what we are going to see is increasingly U.S. support for proxies on the ground. In Iraq, it's the Kurds, and it's the Iraqi security forces, and in some cases, these Shia militias. In Syria, it's the Kurds. It's going to be this Free Syrian Army force that we're building, albeit very, very slowly, much too slowly for a lot of people's preferences, but that's going to be the template. And we've done it in other places like in Somalia. We've done it to a degree in Yemen. We empower the local. We bring our air power, our surveillance, our drone capability, and marry it to proxy forces on the ground. That's the template.
Jack, it's unknowable. What's your gut tell you here, first of all, about the U.S. response? There are some voices in Washington saying more U.S. boots on the ground there. UAE out, Jordan up in arms. Is the Islamic State worse off today than it was a week ago?
It sounds that way, but Tom, I think you've intimated the other side of this. There's a fraction of people for whom this barbarism is catnip. This is exactly what they respond to, and it's like a recruiting mechanism for the alienated, the angry, and God knows Europe and the Middle East are full of such people. And any effect of revulsion may be outweighed by the all you need is a few of these people, but from all over the world. And I'm just fearful that that might be the case.
Jack Beatty, please stand by. Lisa Lehrer with Bloomberg Politics, James Kitfield with National Journal. We're looking at a week in the news, Jordan's fury, a call for U.S. arms to Ukraine, measles outrage, more hacking. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at a week in the news. Lots of talk this week about the possibility of lethal aid to Ukraine. Fierce fighting in eastern Ukraine. Russian-backed rebels there. Russians, many, really. Secretary of State John Kerry there, while the leaders of France and Germany go to Moscow and all over trying to stay away from the arms path. Here's John Kerry blaming the renewed violence in eastern Ukraine on the Kremlin, but saying, look, we don't want conflict with Russia.
We talked about the largest threat that Ukraine faces today, and that is Russia's continued aggression in the East. Now, there's no other way to call it. We're not seeking a conflict with Russia. No one is. Not President Poroshenko, not the United States, not the European Community. That's not what this is about.
That's not what this is about. And true, they want to get to effective talks. But you heard him at the top of the hour saying, but what do you do when Russian tanks are coming across the border? Ukraine's president, Poroshenko, plenty of ideas about that. Here he was speaking before Kerry arrived, saying the Ukrainian leader, he's confident the West would provide Ukraine with the weapons it needs to fight.
I don't have the slightest doubt about the weapon supply to Ukraine from the United States and our other partners. We must have the ability to defend ourselves.
James Kitfield in Houston, Texas. Is the threat of U.S. lethal aid going in there for real? Is it just in the minds of a few people who signed a report that got a lot of attention?
No, it's for real, and I think Poroshenko has exactly right. I think it's going to happen unless there is a big diplomatic push going on this weekend, along with Kerry. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is in Kyiv, as is the French President Hollande. They're going to Moscow today. They're going to present one last attempt to try and reach a peace settlement or some sort of negotiated settlement. If that doesn't happen, I'd be shocked if we don't send weapons. The new presumptive Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, said he was leaning that direction. There's been reports that the SACEUR, General Breedlove, also favors this. There's a huge bipartisan consensus in Congress to do this. So I'd be very surprised if we don't send weapons. This is an inflection point. Russia has essentially invaded Ukraine, eastern Ukraine. They're not hiding it anymore. They're having convoys of tanks and armored personnel carriers going across in daylight. This is a challenge to the West, and they have read it as such.
But, well, you can hear the readiness to do it, certainly politically. 12 senators have called on President Obama to provide lethal aid. Here was Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire just yesterday.
As I look at Vladimir Putin, he is the schoolyard bully, and he's picking on the smaller member of the class. And it's time to provide Ukraine the ability to defend itself.
Lisa Lero, we understand that as a kind of reaction to what everybody's seeing in Ukraine. But is there really enough support to back the president on this, going essentially nose to nose with Russia? Who knows where that would end up?
Well, I mean, clearly the administration's hope is that these deliberations over whether to send these weapons to Ukraine and, you know, also the widely reported news about additional economic sanctions will be sufficient to induce some kind of ceasefire end to the fighting. So they're hoping that's a decision that doesn't have to be made. We'll have to see how this weekend turns out. And there's a couple of different issues at play. One, of course, is economic sanctions. If further increasing the cost to Russia, which has already been pretty crippling to the Russian economy. The second is giving financial support to the Ukraine. And the third, of course, is weapons. So it's a complicated calculus for sure.
Let's go to Jeff calling from Montreal in Canada. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. My first point, I don't think that a military intervention will be very productive. And if one goes back to the Balkans war in the 1990s, where the U.S. Led an air campaign, a bombing campaign against Serbia, a Russian ally, it was a nice, clean war. This is not going to be very nice, and this is not going to be very clean. It's going to cause a tremendous rift within NATO. NATO is on the brink of collapse right now, as we speak, between those countries in Europe which are eager to take Russia on and those countries which are extremely wary of a prolonged conflict as happened in the Balkans and in the last two world wars in Europe.
Let us look at those NATO tensions. Jeff, I appreciate your call. Of course, you've got Poland talking feisty here, ready to send arms itself to Ukraine, but it's right there next to Russia with its own history with Russia. Certainly, Angela Merkel and Hollande out of France talking diplomacy. Here was Merkel headed to Moscow on Wednesday saying diplomacy, diplomacy from Reuters here.
The negotiation process has not yet failed, but it does not lead to results as quickly as we would like. And the situation has become indeed much more serious. But the attempt of diplomatic efforts must continue.
Must continue. A German leader who chooses her words carefully. James Kitfield, what about pressures, tensions within NATO? Do you see the rift that our caller describes?
Well, I actually don't think NATO is anywhere near falling apart on this. NATO won't provide weapons. It'll be a coalition of the willing led by the United States because, as your listener says, there's not consensus, and NATO operates by unanimity. So there's not consensus in NATO to do this, but clearly, and this is part of the diplomacy. You know, basically, if you don't have any leverage in diplomacy, you don't get very far with people like Vladimir Putin. So he has all the cards in eastern Ukraine. There's no way Ukraine can fight him. They can't even defend themselves without, you know, additional weapons from us. And there's a increasing consensus in the U.S. government that unless we get some leverage, we'll never get him to actually negotiate seriously. I mean, this is the fourth time we've presented him with a chance to back down, and each time he's doubled down. So if we don't have, the sanctions are leverage, but they're not enough leverage to stop him, obviously. And the hope is if you provide enough weapons for Ukraine to defend itself, it'll become costly for Russia to do this, and that'll give you leverage to get him to the negotiating table. But absent some leverage, it's very hard to see, because he's time and time again been given a chance to sort of, you know, back away from this, and each time he's doubled down.
Of course, leverage when it's arms can get tricky and hurry. Jack?
Yeah, well, what about this leverage question? You know, suppose this doesn't work. Suppose an increment of arms doesn't work. Well, U.S. credibility is at stake. Let's have some more arms, and more arms will be furnished. And today's Times, what does it say? The Ukrainian military is honeycombed with Russian agents, and there's a great fear that any weapons we give to the Ukrainian military will merely go over to the rebels eventually, or some of them will. You know, there's an asymmetry of interests here. Ukraine's direction is a vital interest of Russia. Historically, geographically, that's just the case. The power shift in Ukraine with the Maidan Revolution went against Russia. That is the kind of thing that nations fight over. For us, Ukraine is at best a concern. We would like to have a world in which Ukrainian invasions like this don't happen. But to think that somehow pouring in more weapons is going to change. You know, in Vietnam, they call this raising the price of aggression. Well, you know, it didn't work then because we were up against nationalism. I can't think of anything more calculated to, you know, raise that feeling again in Russia than U.S. arms. And meanwhile, what about our overriding strategic priority? Our countries avoiding war with Iran. That's our vital interest. That would be another preventive war, of which Bismarck says it's like a man killing himself from fear of death. We can't go that way again. Russia can scupper any chance of our reaching an agreement with Iran. That's our overriding priority, not this distant matter in Ukraine.
So many fronts to consider. Phil in Dubuque, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Phil. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. I don't think we should send arms. I wonder why people aren't talking anymore about the recorded phone call of Victoria Nuland, you know, showing that we engineered the Maidan coup. In fact, Obama acknowledged that recently. And also in the last couple of days, the chief of staff of the Ukrainian military came out and said, we are not fighting Russian soldiers in the eastern Ukraine.
All right. I mean, that's the Russian line. Certainly that the U.S. pushed all this unrest. I've seen an awful lot of people saying that you essentially do have Russian soldiers. There are reporters telling us this week they've got the very latest Russian equipment in there at the very least. But still, to be in there, I don't know. Phil, thanks. Mark in Rochester, New York. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Tom. We could give Ukraine warehouses of Tomahawks and squadrons of fighters. It wouldn't make any difference. Ukraine, even with the best technology in the world, short of nuclear weapons, still wouldn't have any chance against an actual Russian offensive. If the Russian government wants to militaristically seize the Ukraine, I don't think the Ukrainians, no matter what their level of weaponry is, have the ability to stop them. It's not even a question of whether we should, in my opinion. It's a question of whether, if we do, it'll make any difference. If it won't make any difference, which I don't think it will, given the disparity between the Ukraine and Russia militaristically, then why would we take the risk of international complication, let alone the expense, to achieve nothing?
I mean, you may be right, Mark. The analysis we heard earlier this week that was that one thing Vladimir Putin doesn't want, with all the economic tension inside his country now, troubles, is images of Russian soldiers coming home dead. If we raise the price, is an argument that's been made, that might be the leverage. Lisa, I want to ask you about Ashton Carter, who, of course, has been having confirmation hearings this week to be defense secretary, the nominee there. Here he was saying on Wednesday that he is leaning toward giving Ukraine lethal aid.
But I incline in the direction of providing them with arms, including to get to what I'm sure your question is, lethal arms.
How do you interpret that, Lisa? How was that heard? Does that mean this is serious? Does that mean he thinks it's a good idea that could actually work, or is he just getting confirmed?
Well, certainly that point cheered a lot of hawks in Congress who would like to see us move forward with arming Ukraine. But the question for Ashton Carter is the same question that faced all his predecessors, as well as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other officials, who ended up being pretty much rolled by the White House and the National Security Council. So the question is how much power he's really going to have inside the administration, or is the decision-making still going to really happen among a close-knit group of aides at the White House. And that's something that, you know, we're going to have to wait and see how that plays out, if he can do things differently and have more power than, you know, his predecessors did. I think the other thing worth pointing out here from the White House perspective is that one of the concerns they have is that they see President Putin as a bit of a erratic player that makes them worry, you know, wary of proclaiming any kind of progress, wary of predicting what he's going to do. And one little news story this week that I sort of found a little bit amusing was this report that the Defense Department had put out a diagnosis in a 2008 report saying that that President Putin had Asperger's syndrome. And that's something that the White House didn't dismiss entirely, amusingly, this week. Yeah. They said, I believe Josh Earnest's quote was, I'm not saying it's uncredible necessarily. I'm just saying I don't have my own personal reaction. So what
What does that mean? The White House saying he's a troubled man.
Yeah, they didn't want to weigh in on whether Putin has Asperger's. They certainly didn't dismiss the idea. But what they're really saying here is that he's an erratic player. And I think that definitely is the White House's view of things.
One more on Ukraine. Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on.
Thank you. Jack, I'm absolutely furious with you. There's no comparison between Ukraine and Vietnam. The Vietnamese had absolutely no interest in the war. They did not want to fight at all. They did not care what their future was going to be. The Ukrainians do care. They do want their own independence. Whether or not Russia has an interest in Ukraine is absolutely, positively irrelevant. The Ukrainians want to decide their own future, period. They have a right to decide their own future. They have a right to fight for their own future.
Hey, Bill, an awful lot of South Vietnamese died in that war, and many took to sea to escape the North Vietnamese when they did come to power. I don't know if you can say they had no interest in the war, but Jack, pick it up, the notion that there is no parallel here, and Ukraine has a right to self-determination.
Well, on the parallel, I was referring to the North Vietnamese, and specifically to Robert McNamara's, you know, epiphany. In the fog of war, he said, you know, we realized that they would pay any price because we were up against not international communism, but whipped up nationalism. And that seems to be the Trump in the 20th century. He was shocked that, of course, at the time, people were saying you're fighting nationalism.
But whose nationalism should Trump in Ukraine, Jack? Russian or Ukrainian?
Well, now that's certainly true in point of what's right. What Bill says is absolutely true. What's right is that Ukraine should be able to determine its own future. But right is not the major counter here. Geography is. Tiny states on the border of big states always have to watch themselves. They have to Finlandize themselves, as they said in the time of the Cold War, or join NATO. Well, NATO is out for Ukraine, or at least now. And, you know, they have sort of indicated they want to Finlandize. Now, whether that's going to, which is to say we want to be benign toward Russia, but whether they can do that and represent the base that brought this government to power is a stretch. And you know, it's just a truism that you know, what's right and what is and the decisive nature of power in international affairs means Russia has an overriding interest. And you know, from what I understand, this Putin plan involves a kind of Transnistria idea. That's the enclave in Moldova that is essentially a Russian state enclave, and that's sort of what they want, something like that along the borders. And, you know, if they have the power to get it, if the West can't stop them from getting it, Ukraine, I think, probably has to give way.
Transnistria. Okay. Lisa Lehrer, how do you expect this to go down in Washington? Is it already being settled? Do you see Kerry kind of bowing to Merkel and Hollande, who seem to be signaling very loudly, no, we want diplomacy here, or... enough call for this in Washington, enough agreement in the White House security circles that this may actually happen, lethal aid.
Well, nothing is settled, but certainly not off the table. There is some bipartisan agreement in Congress. You saw a number of senators come out this week, a bipartisan group come out pushing for this. So I think everyone is waiting to see what will happen this weekend, where we are diplomatically, and move forward from there.
Well, it has been...
Tom, can I...
Yes,
can
please,
I,
James.
Can I cut in? Just, you know, there is a principle here, and it hasn't been mentioned yet, so I'm going to mention it, because I wrote in this week, and every former and present NATO official mentioned it to me, which is... you know, Russia has proclaimed the right to, in its near abroad, to intercede into other, across national borders to protect, quote unquote, protect Russian-speaking people. Well, three of those countries on its border that were a big portion of Russian-speaking people are the NATO members, including Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania.
Yeah.
We're very concerned that if we just sit back and let this principle become a precedent, that Putin will read that as weakness, which he's done in the past, and start looking towards NATO members, and there's a lot of concern about that.
Imagine having a personal library with over 150,000 titles. Fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, every category imaginable. Now imagine having a personal assistant read them to you in your car, on the train, wherever you want. That's what it's like to have Audible.com. On Point listeners get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint. Download a free title and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. Get started today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Super Bowl, 30 seconds to go. The Seattle Seahawks down by four, half a yard from the goal line, and then...
Wilson, quick throw. And it's good. Intercepted. Malcolm Butler. Butler has it at the one. Malcolm Butler stepped in front of the throw.
No way.
And the Patriots have possession.
No way. Crushing loss. Thrilling victory, and people will never forget. Anchor in the hot seat, NBC's Brian Williams now says his helicopter did not come under fire in Iraq.
I want to apologize. I said I was traveling in an aircraft that was hit by RPG fire. I was instead in a following aircraft.
A half an hour behind. 55 years after To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee will release another novel. Fans, including Julie Turberville of Monroe, Alabama, very excited.
Oh, I bet it's going to be great. The first one was, too.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
Sir?
Did he climb inside of his skin? Walk around in it.
Back to the book, the movie that everybody loved. We're looking at a week in the news. Jordan's fury, a call for U.S. arms to Ukraine, measles outrage, more hacking. And we, and a lot of people, been thinking about vaccines this week. It's family level, it's personal level, it's public policy level, and this week, also political. Here in an interview with CNBC on Monday, Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky saying he thinks the decision to vaccinate should be entirely voluntary.
I've heard of many tragic cases of walking, talking, normal children who wound up with profound mental disorders after vaccines. I'm not arguing vaccines are a bad idea. I think they're a good thing. But I think the parents should have some input. The state doesn't own your children. Parents own the children.
All kinds of science saying they're fine, but there's Rand Paul saying, you know, profound mental disorders after the vaccine. Well, Governor Christie, Chris Christie, got into this a little bit. This was on Monday. He backpedaled later, but he was in London. He was asked if Americans should vaccinate their kids or not, and you can hear him kind of splitting the difference here.
All I can say is that we vaccinate ours, and so, you know, that's the best expression I can give you my opinion. You know, it's much more important, I think, what you think as a parent than what you think as a public official. And that's what we do. But I also understand that parents need to have some measure of choice in things as well. So that's the balance that the government has to decide.
Choice. There's been a lot of choice not to be vaccinated, and we've got plenty of measles right now. Jeb Bush, sort of straight and simple here. Here he is in Detroit at the Detroit Economic Club on Wednesday.
Parents have a responsibility to make sure their children are protected over and out.
I guess you can interpret that a lot of ways, but he seemed to be saying vaccinate. Patricia in New Orleans, thank you very much for calling, Patricia. What do you think on the vaccination front?
Oh, hi. I've listened to your show all the time, but this is the first time I'm calling in.
Great. Welcome.
All I wanted to say was that parents do have the right to make those decisions for their children. Doctors do not always agree with parents' decisions regarding their children's health care. If you decide that you don't want blood products for your children, that's your decision. If you decide your children shouldn't eat meat or gluten, that's your decision. But I also think that these parents should be held responsible for the consequences of their actions. If your child contracts the measles, or if you decide to fly to Afghanistan and your kid picks up polio, you know, because there are countries where they're having those outbreaks as well, and you bring that back over here, I believe that a lot more parents would feel more motivated to go ahead and vaccinate their children if they had to accept the financial responsibility for the health care of their children after they get sick.
But, Patricia, who can possibly accept responsibility for, let's say, another child's death or brain damage or for an outbreak? You know, we had none, and now we have a pretty good start on an outbreak here. What family, you know, can pay for that?
That will be a motivator for parents to accept that if you decide this is the lifestyle that you want to lead, if you decide you want your children not to be in their car seat and they fly through a window, parents have to be held responsible for that. You have endangered a minor.
Patricia, we've got it. Freedom, but then be responsible. I'm not sure how to take responsibility for something potentially so very, very large. Lisa Lehrer, help us with the politics of this here. We heard Rand Paul. He seems pretty clearly supporting that right to choose that Patricia's talking about. Chris Christie seemed to be supporting that as well. Jeb Bush seemed a little more straightforward. Did Republicans get in trouble on this week or not?
Oh, I think it was pretty clear that at least Senator Paul and Governor Christie were not quite used to the sharp spotlight that comes when you're almost thinking about a presidential campaign. And what you have in that kind of situation is any issue can really flare up. And they both of those potential candidates really seem to struggle with these kinds of high-pressure interactions that are pretty standard for a presidential candidate. So from a political standpoint, I think there are a lot of questions about how ready either one of them are for a full-blown presidential campaign. But there are some political trends in the Republican Party that would lead them to make these kinds of statements. I think a lot of people think of folks who don't vaccinate their kids as sort of left wing, you know, moms out in the Bay Area who are, you know, environmentally conscious, things like that, or parents who are worried about that thoroughly discredited study linking vaccines to autism. But there is a strain in the Republican Party of libertarians who don't like this idea of the government mandating certain things. That's a big debate. Vaccines are a big debate within the libertarian community. And also there is some correlation between people who homeschool and people who don't get their children vaccinated. And homeschoolers, of course, are a pretty strong contingent in Iowa, which is a very important state in presidential politics. So I think both Christie and Paul were trying to sort of navigate these conflicting politics within their party. But I think basically the rest of the party quickly decided the next day that it was the wrong thing to do, and they didn't want to enter 2016 as looking like Republicans were the party of leeches and bloodletting here. They wanted to be up to date with modern science.
Jack Beatty, do you think Rand Paul will really walk that back? He's got a strong libertarian impulse here. On the other hand, there's public health.
Yeah, indeed. You know, Tom, a few days after his landslide election in 2010, his wife, Kelly, gave him a copy of Emily Dickinson's poem, Fame is a Bee. Fame is a bee. It has a song. It has a sting. Ah, too, it has a wing. Well, he's in the spotlight of fame. He has had his moments. He had the filibuster, as we remember, against Obama's drone policy, got him a lot of attention. On the other hand, in the spotlight of fame, he's tripped up again and again. Just this fall, he was crediting something he'd seen on the web that linked John McCain, of all people, with the head of ISIS, that somehow they had been together on the same platform. I mean, and this was a total bogus thing on the web. He and periodically, when he is confronted with something spontaneous, you know, spontaneous challenge, he reverts to the libertarianism, the randism of his youth, and the result is, well, it's this kind of thing. He talks about the right to health care. He said a few years ago, it means you believe in slavery. It means you're going to enslave not only me, the doctor, but the janitor at my hospital, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He has shown himself again and again to be sort of walking on the eggshells of his own biography, which he was steeped in the deep dish conspiratorial thinking of the Austrian economists.
Plenty of politics here. Also, very personal decisions to be made all over this country, or being made in any case. Carol in Austin, Texas. Carol, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. About vaccination, I've had a hand in raising 5 children.
Okay.
The first 2 vaccinated, not vaccinated, perfectly fine, healthy, functioning second two, 16-year-old and 11-year-old, vaccinated. My 16-year-old has autism. My 11-year-old has Asperger's syndrome. I've got a 2-year-old that I'm at a crossroads at what to do concerning vaccinations for him. So this is a tough call for me. I don't know where to go for that because the conflicting medical, and I've watched my two kids with disabilities. It's hard.
Holy cow, what a story. Carol, what does your doctor say to you about your own family history there?
And they say vaccinate. That's all they say. They say it shouldn't be up for debate. Just vaccinate my 2-year-old.
Carol, I appreciate your call. Lisa Lehrer, boy, when you hear a story like that, it feeds right into the narrative, but it's more than a narrative to Carol, Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, these are intensely personal decisions. And a lot of it, there's been some interesting studies actually out of Europe based on the H1N1 vaccine. And sociologists looked at who decided in Europe to get that vaccine and who didn't. And one thing that they found was that the major indicator ended up being trust in institutions, both the country's healthcare system and sort of trust in the government generally. And I think that's part of why, granted, Europeans' relationship with their government is very different than the American relationship, but there is something to that. And I think that's part of why you see this issue flaring up on the Republican side. All the polling indicates that trust, you know, Americans' trust in government is at record lows, but it's particularly low among Republicans. And there also tend to be more skepticism of science in the Republican Party. There's polling that shows that, too. So those factors are combining to make this a difficult issue in the Republican primary, and one that, as much as party leaders want to not be a litmus test, you know, in the 2016 elections, they want this to go away. I suspect it will flare back up, given the kinds of personal decisions that people are facing.
Carol, in Austin, I just want to acknowledge that we hear that it's not hypothetical to you, and we wish strength to your family. Ray, in North Kingston, Rhode Island. Ray, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
I wanted to talk about the Brian Williams thing.
Yeah, what a mess.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I have a very, very good friend who is a decorated Vietnam War veteran, and was actually shot down in a helicopter. And not only does he remember it from 45 years ago, but he remembers it in vivid detail. And that's pretty typical of military personnel who have been involved in combat situations. And for Brian Williams to go on with this fabricated story and recite it several times it's just an egregious insult to all of the military and military personnel, past and present, who have ever fought.
Ray, I appreciate your call. James Kibbehill, let me bring this one to you. 2003, Brian Williams saying in an NBC segment here that he had this, what he called a close call in the skies over Iraq. The Chinook ahead of us was almost blown out of the sky. Last year on David Letterman, says he was actually on the helicopter that got shot down. Last week on Nightly News, described, quoting here, a terrible moment a dozen years back during the invasion of Iraq when the helicopter we were traveling in was forced down after being hit by an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade. Of course, a very public apology this week. And look, the temptation, it may be irresistible to embroider this history, but for a news anchor, this is pretty tough, James. Where does this go?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this with some interest to see where it goes. I mean, he made a mistake in, you know, he basically embellished a story because he thought it made a good story.
But embellished himself all the way into a chopper that went down when his was a half hour behind or an hour behind or something.
I don't know that it was a half hour behind.
Well,
I mean,
that's what I'm reading here.
Is that right?
Yes, I mean, the New York Times saying, at least by one account, it was a different part of the mission, at least 30 minutes behind the one that went down.
Yeah, so I haven't looked at all the details of this. I mean, it's clear from his apology that he conflated these stories. That he was in a helicopter flying over dangerous territory. A helicopter that same day, or just in front of him, 30 mm-hmm. minutes, was forced down by fire, and he basically said that happened to me. That's a no-no. And you know how serious that is to his reputation and his legitimacy. I think only his viewership can discuss. You know, personally, I think it was a bad mistake. mistake for a journalist to do. On the other hand, the it is kind of a human failing to want to sort of – he was in a war zone. He was reporting, and he embellished it. I've seen it happen from soldiers. I've seen it happen from journalists. It happens.
A human failing or foible that we want news anchors to resist, if at all possible. I want to talk about budget this week a little bit, the big perspective on the country's economy. Here is at the hearing of the House Ways and Means Committee on Tuesday. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew was here saying the president's budget out this week, 2016, fiscally responsible, designed to help struggling families.
This budget is built around the basic idea that hard work should pay off. It's practical, not partisan. And it lays out clear steps to rein in spending and eliminate wasteful tax breaks so we can reduce taxes for working families as well as many businesses and manufacturers.
Okay, then Sunday on Meet the Press, seeing this thing coming, we had Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, Wisconsin, criticizing the whole agenda, said the president's economic plan isn't keeping with American character, so we've got a stagnant economy, said Ryan.
Look, the president has done two big rounds of tax increases. It's one of the reasons why we have the stagnant economy we do. He's practicing, yet again, envy economics, and it doesn't work. We are an aspirational people. We're an optimistic people, and our policies should reflect that in our country. And that is not the kind of economic policy or politics the president practices.
Envy economics. Stagnant economy. Jack Beatty, jobs report out today says 257,000 jobs, the biggest 3 months of job creation in 17 years. And envy economics, I don't know, what do you think of the president's path, middle-class economics, Paul Ryan's envy economics?
Well, it's a good tag. It just doesn't seem to have any empirical backing. I mean, the fact is the economy has not fallen off a cliff, just the opposite since the upper income people had to pay more taxes. The economy has not faltered with the implementation of Obamacare. On the contrary, it has grown. And this month we see now even a tick up in wages. You know, the Republicans have one answer to middle-class economics. They like the idea of helping people, and they certainly concede now that inequality is a huge problem. They just don't want to seem to really do anything about it that departs from their catechism of tax cuts. Paul Ryan has just come out with some more, and deregulation. And so they're caught having to say no to free community college, no to family leave, no, no, no. They may be right that all those things are bad for the country. It's not good politics, though, to keep saying no to things that many, many Americans want.
Lisa, we've just got 10 seconds here. This budget, a philosophical document? Anything in it that's going to actually be adopted in this Republican Congress?
Very little. There's a possibility that something could happen on corporate taxes, but it's going to be a tough slog.
Lisa Lehrer with Bloomberg Politics. We're up against the clock here, but grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thank you so much for joining us, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
James Kitfield with National Journal out of Houston. Thank you, James, for being here today.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
And Jack, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.